What I'd like to do is just host some time here for question and answer. And one of the things I do want to ask, though, is that we not have a statement and response, that it be a question and answer. And so if you do have something that you want to preface a question with, that's great. But this is, I don't want this to be a time of statements and interacting that way, but of question and answer and really asking questions and seeking to wrestle. And loaded questions, you know, they're going to happen at times, right? But, you know, loaded questions are questions with another question behind it, and we'll have to discern some of those types of things. So we do want this to be a faith forum. We do want this to be wrestling with these things and not specifically stating our opinions about things, okay? So with that being said, questions. We've got two mics up here as well, and so please ask your questions into a mic, and then I'll let you guys respond.
Jeff McCutcheon. And so first of all, I just want to say thank you to both of you. You did a great job. And so you've just done a really nice job. So one of my first questions is from a theological standpoint. You know, looking at Jesus going to Egypt at the behest of God, do you view all immigrants here as God's provision? Illegally or legally? So that's... It's a double question, because that helps me. That's something during your presentation, made me think about that, is with the difficulty to get here, whether illegal or legal, the fact that they're here, should we view them here as through God's providence?
Yeah.
And I have a second question.
I would say the passage that comes to mind as I think about that question would be in Acts chapter 17, where Paul is on Mars Hill, and he says, "From one man, God made every nation of men, and he established the exact times and places where they should live." And he goes on to say he did this for a reason, that he was not willing that men might seek him and might find him. So that's not to say I'm condoning how different people necessarily got here, but I do think God is sovereign over where people happen to be in the earth, and that God has a purpose in those things. And I think that I've seen both immigrants who came through a legal process and those who came other than legally or came temporarily legally and then lost their status. And I've seen God draw people to himself in the midst of that process. So I think that's sort of my view of God's sovereignty, is without discounting either the importance of U.S. law or the complex factors of that either compel or encourage people to migrate, whether that's poverty or persecution or war, I think that above all that is the hand of God in the movement of people towards an end. And I think that Acts 17 speaks to that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us. And my hope would be that the church wouldn't miss that, what I think is a divinely orchestrated opportunity.
And I'll just add really quickly, from an immigrant's perspective, absolutely yes. So to this day, my mom and I are the only Christians in our family, and we are very active in sharing the gospel with my family members, extended family members in China, but they're also very... very resistant, although my grandpa actually, in his elderly years, he's been, at least for my granddaughters, when I call him, less so for my mom, but for him, I think he just can't say no to me. but he has been receptive to the gospel, more receptive to the gospel. And I just think if it weren't for God bringing us here, I don't think my family would have ever had the chance, including mom and I, would have ever had the chance to hear the gospel.
Follow-up question, that's okay. One of the things for me has been, and I like your presentation, is differentiating between the legal and the illegal immigrant. And I know that when we watch the news, it's, you know, where the drumbeat is drummed to us, the consequences of illegal immigrants who do bad things. You know, I think of the woman in San Francisco who, you know, ended up being murdered. And so the question is, do you think it's within, potentially within God's providence, that some of those illegal immigrants that do come to the U.S. and do things that are poor, is it possible that God brings them here so that justice could be enacted? And so is it something where that person might not experience justice in their own country, but when they come here, it's something where they're experiencing something of God working in their lives because they are going to experience justice. And do you see it possible that he's working that as an avenue too, so we shouldn't be surprised that not everyone coming here, but we're blessed to be in a country where we do have laws and law enforcement that is generally very trustworthy. And thank you. I'll sit.
You got tough questions, because ultimately this has come to some extent. We could have a debate over Calvinism or Arminianism and exactly how God's sovereignty works. But I would say two things. First of all, I think God does, to kind of restate what I already said, I think God has purposes in the movement of people. I don't think we can always understand them, and I would be wary to necessarily in every case say, I see how God is at work here, because sometimes I don't know what God's doing, and that's not just with migration, that's with lots of situations in the world. But I do ultimately believe in that God is in control. I also think it's important to know that there are cases where immigrants who are here illegally have done horrific things, and the one in San Francisco is a prime example of that. But it's easy to see that enough on the television to think that that's like a typical case, and it's actually not. If you look at the FBI statistics, immigrants in general are significantly less likely to commit crimes than native-born U.S. citizens. And immigrants who are here unlawfully are incarcerated at about half the rate of native-born U.S. citizens. Again, that doesn't mean none of them have done terrible things. Some of them have. But it's not an accurate presumption, which I think is very much was my presumption from just watching TV before I started working in this. It's not accurate that they're disproportionately criminal in some ways. In fact, and I don't think that's because they're more virtuous. I actually think it's a function of immigration law. Because if you are a U.S. citizen and you steal a candy bar, I'll use the state of Indiana because I had a case like this once. If you steal a candy bar in the state of Indiana, it's a misdemeanor offense, very much kind of a slap on the wrist. Like, you'll probably pay a fine and very unlikely you'd spend any time in jail in Indiana. If you are an immigrant with legal status, with a green card, and you steal the same candy bar, well, that misdemeanor offense is also a crime involving moral turpitude, and it's a deportable offense, or could be a deportable offense. And then just to show you how confusing immigration law is, in Illinois, you'd have to steal candy bars in two different equations to be deportable. Like, it's the way the state laws are written makes it complicated. If you're here unlawfully, you don't even have to have stolen the candy bar. You just have to have been suspected of stealing the candy bar, and in certain municipalities, at the point you're interacting with the police, they're going to run a check on your immigration status. So there's a strong disincentive towards crime, or that is to say, there's a strong incentive not to ever interact with police. If you are here unlawfully, or frankly, even if you're here lawfully with valid status, but you're not yet a citizen. And I see that, again, I live in a neighborhood where it's 90% Hispanic. I think most, I don't know what percentage of my neighbors have legal status or not, but a good number don't. And people drive so slow. Which is probably to say they're driving the speed limit. But most people in Chicagoland tend to think that when they said the speed limit on I-88 was 55, they didn't really mean that. Maybe a little bit higher than that. You notice that. Like, people are very cautious drivers because they know that even a small traffic violation might get them in some serious trouble. And all the more, a serious criminal offense. That doesn't mean some of them aren't people who have done horrific things, and I'm all for those people if they ever get out of jail being deported. But I also think it's easy when we just see one story repeated over and over to think this is sort of a typical case, and it's, in that case at least, it's not.
Right. Could you kind of address the idea of finding a balance? Let's say we are, loving our neighbors and bringing, welcoming that love to any immigrants, but balancing that need to witness and to bring in what would be our own cultural imposition of a Western faith, essentially, with immigrants that come in with their own traditions, own belief systems, and where that, how to be more culturally sensitive to those things.
Liz, you're an immigrant. You want to take that?
Yeah. Well, I came without religious beliefs, but I think a lot of it just kind of, this may be an oversimplified answer, but I think a lot of it just boils down to loving the individual and not maybe starting off with a perspective or looking at them as an evangelistic target, but more of how can I love this individual? How can I get to know this individual and holistically, right? So I think that's what my youth pastor did, is he didn't just look at the kind of the convenient side of my life and say, well, this is the clean part and the good part, but he also looked at, well, here are the things that I'm wrestling with my immigration status. And Matt mentioned at World Relief, we don't proselytize, but I think when immigrants or refugees, be it that they're coming from non-religious background or with a different religion, when they actually sense that genuine love, which is what my mom did actually, seeing that genuine, authentic love lived out, that you know, naturally prompts questions about why it is that you do what you do. So I think that's a great question, because I think we definitely want to also err on the side of respecting people with their belief system as they come. Again, not seeing them as projects, but as people, and as a journey to faith.
The only thing I would add to that is I think it probably depends if you're talking on sort of a national policy level or like individual church level. One of the kind of buzzwords we use around World Relief a lot is the idea of integration. So integration is it's a model of acculturation. It's a way that people from one culture fit into another. But it's not by marginalization, which is where we're going to put them off in the corner and keep them away from everybody. It's also not a strictly assimilation model that says you came from there, but now you're going to be like this. Like, stop eating that food, stop speaking that language. You know, you have to worship God exactly the way that we do, and, you know, whatever the background is. It's, at least on a national level, and I would say the religious dynamics are obviously important, because I don't, you know, we believe in Jesus, and I'm not saying we, like, mix that halfway with others. But as a national level, we don't have an established religion in this country. We have a First Amendment that actually says we shall not establish any particular religion. So I think there you're looking for, will people be, you know, do they want to abide by the principles of the U.S. Constitution? That's sort of the creed that people need to be up for. And then beyond that, like, if you're going to eat different foods, that's fine. In fact, this country has been enriched by all the people who brought different foods over the generations. We sell more salsa in this country now than ketchup, and I think that's a good thing. It's a superior condiment. And if you looked at this 200 years ago, you know, it would have been something else that was changing. Because every group, the idea of integration is actually every group becomes part of the whole, and in a tiny way, changes what that whole looks like as well, by bringing parts of who they are culturally. I don't know any immigrants who don't want to learn English. Like, I know some who've tried it a lot harder than others. And it's hard when you come at your 70 years old, or, you know, or even you're 40 years old and you've got to work 15 hours a day. But, you know, in my experience, like, my wife teaches English classes. She has students who are very desperate to learn the language because they know that it will allow them to advance economically. It'll allow them to interact with their kids, frankly. Like, their kids don't speak their native language usually very well, not to mention their kids' teachers and others around society. So I think it is a mix, but I like that model of integration more than just to say, you know, you're here now, stop speaking your language, stop eating your food. And again, from a Christian perspective, it's being ready to give an answer for the hope that's within you, but doing so with gentleness and respect. And recognizing that on a Christian level, English isn't necessarily God's favorite language. Like, I had a guy at a church once tell me, then why did he write the Bible in English? turns out that's not quite right. But I think we want to be very careful of the very natural human tendency towards viewing our own culture as the best and as the norm from which all others are compared. The beautiful thing about the United States is that we've done a fairly good job of integration. I think you could look at particular European countries that have had a really poor model of immigrant integration. They have basically marginalized people. They put them all in one neighborhood, and they often don't find jobs very easily, and they are isolated. And that's frankly a recipe for radicalization in a way that we've largely avoided in the United States. And I think it's in part because of a strong history of integration. And radicalization, whether that's in a particular religious tradition or, I mean, that can happen in different ways.
I have 100 questions. No. My name's Lori. Hi. Thank you again. Narrow it to 3. Does World Relief, the website, have a bibliography with all of the stats or many of the stats that you... Okay.
Because
it's very different than what we hear from time to time.
The best place, and I'm not just saying this to sell books, but on refugees, I co-wrote a book called Seeking Refuge, which, yep. I don't know, do we have some of those here? We have some of those here.
Okay.
So that would be the, okay. It's Most of those things would be somewhere on the World Relief website, but maybe an easier to find would be the book. Or on immigrants more generally, it's a little out of date because it came out in 2009 and the new edition won't be out till this summer, but there's another book called Welcoming the Stranger. So almost anything we said tonight would be in one of those books.
Thank you. Liz, for someone like me that really doesn't have a history as far as understanding DACA, you were a recipient on a particular date. You understood it was temporary, and I thought I heard you say 2 years. Mm-hmm. However long ago that was, what were you expecting? I mean, what was the next step? I'll stop there because it looks to me like you might understand the question.
Yeah, so it is 2 years, and I apologize, I didn't mention it's two years renewable as long as the program was in place. So DACA, yeah, 2 years, you apply for renewal, pay another hefty fee to do that, and go through biometric fingerprinting and checks. So you can do that, you can kind of continue. Now, DACA, deferred action, is not status, so it does not grant long-term status, and it does not create a pathway in which you've been in the DACA program long enough, then you can eventually go into legal permanent residency or green card. Citizenship, green card, up here, same. But it's just a kind of a temporary relief, so to speak, yeah. Now, the deferred action program has been rescinded by the current administration as of last September, September 5th. And there has been, and it speaks to kind of almost the chaotic and kind of complex nature of immigration, there has been some court orders to then put the cancellation, kind of put a temporary injunction on that.
And
renewals are allowed. But I don't know what the future is, actually, long-term future is for this.
If it wouldn't have been rescinded, Would your intention have been to continue to renew it on an every other year basis for the rest of your life? I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at.
So it is in itself kind of a limbo status. You don't know what's going to happen. The only thing to allow us to be on that pathway is legislation that comes out of Congress. Mm-hmm. And that's what we believe too. Congress should be the body enacting laws, mm-hmm. Including immigration. So for me and my mom, as believers now, the way that we see this is, and we have been in fervent prayer too, and see how God provides. Actually, after we found out about our immigration issue and after mom realized that there was little we could do here to kind of correct that, we prayed very hard and asked people to pray about whether we should be going back to China or we should be staying here. And we actually arrived at a point, if God was calling us to China, if that was the path, we would be okay with that. Because ultimately, we want to follow God's will. But for some reason, God just kept on opening doors. Now, that is not to say, and it is a difficult decision to make, because technically, I'm undocumented. But that's just, I think, hopefully, in some way, help portray this difficult decision and wrestling that we have to go through. In terms of, do we stay, do we leave? In our case, for my mom and I, we can go back to China. We have families there, but for a lot of people I know, and I've come across and very privileged to work with a lot of immigrants and refugees, they simply cannot return back to their country of origin because of extreme violence or abject poverty or natural disaster, whatever it may be. So that was something that I would, preferably, the plan is, I guess, based on what I know, is yes, keep renewing DACA, because if we were to leave the United States now, that's essentially a closed door for at least 10 years with no guarantee of reentry. We're ready to go back to China if that's where God has called us or any other country, but it's just that until we fix our status, it's really hard to have that just closed door to the U.S.
Last quick one, hopefully. What do you say to people when they say, we only have so many resources, and we have needs of citizens or children of citizens, and just help me say more about that. Thank you very much.
The first thing I would say is I don't think you're going to find a number of visas that the U.S. should have each year in the Bible, so I want to be really careful. I'm not saying, like, the Bible says we need, 400,000 immigrant worker visas or 350,000. Like, those are going to be prudential judgments that, you know, I think Christians can disagree on in terms of the questions of policy. My view, though, is the reason, and again, this is my personal view, so don't send angry emails to the pastor.
Amen.
I think that the primary reason we have so many people unlawfully present in the country is a disconnect between the number of visas that we have and the needs of our U.S. labor market. And that's because our immigration laws were largely written in 1965. And by the way, I think they were an improvement over what we had before 1965. But our laws that were passed in 65 and have been updated sporadically, but most of the visa quotas have been fairly stable, might have fit the needs of the U.S. economy in 1965, but are way out of touch with the needs of the U.S. labor market now. Because yes, there are U.S. citizens who are unemployed, although we're approaching 4% unemployment. That's a very low level unemployment. There's particular industries within our country where they have a very hard time recruiting labor. Agriculture is probably the most prominent, but there are other industries as well. Home health care, I mean, as more and more baby boomers are requiring health assistance, especially in home, it's not that there's no U.S. citizens willing to do that job, but there's not enough applying for those jobs to meet the growing needs in certain industries, especially agriculture. I mean, the significant majority of farm workers in the United States are immigrants. And we can say, well, that they should just pay more, but the reality is then you might ship the whole industry out of the United States, because we can also buy strawberries from Mexico. And maybe that would be good for Mexico if we did. I mean, you move the whole industry. But then it's not just the farm worker who loses their job. It's the farmer here. It's the truck driver here. It's up and down the supply chain. So most economists think, actually, I mean, they'll disagree where the exact right number for visas is, but the vast majority of economists actually think that the current number is not in the optimal interest of the U.S. economy, that a number that was closer to the demand for workers in particular sectors of the economy. So, for example, high-skill workers who come in and start Google or Yahoo or Intel or any number of other companies started by immigrants employ a whole bunch of Americans. But you also need adequate workers in agriculture, in the hospitality industry. And some of that's going to vary regionally as well. One thing that economists find with immigrants is they're more mobile, meaning they will go to where there's a job. And part of that is they've already left everything behind. So once you've left your country, you'll move 3 hours to get paid an extra dollar an hour. Most U.S. citizens, and this isn't good or bad, I'm not criticizing, but, you know, we're tied to a place, and it would take a lot more incentive to leave behind what we're used to. But that gives immigrants some flexibility that allows them to meet needs of a dynamic labor market. Because to say, talk about the U.S. economy is almost, I mean, the economy in Los Angeles is very different than the economy in Minneapolis, which is very different than the economy in eastern Kentucky. So I think that's my view of the fundamental flaw of the U.S. immigration system, is an archaic immigration quota system that I honestly had no idea before I worked in immigration law how limited it was. I thought we had some sort of version of Ellis Island, where, you know, which we did 100 years ago, where you showed up, and of course now it's not on a boat, but there was some sort of office you would go to, and you'd probably stand in some literal turnstiles, and it was probably like the Department of Motor Vehicles, like maybe not the best customer service. I'm sorry if any of you work for the DMV. I'm sure you're great here. But, you know, it was like a kind of bureaucratic governmental experience, and you pay a fine and fill out the right form, and it was a little difficult, but you left with your green card. And I literally, that was just how I presumed it worked. And then I became an immigration legal counselor, and my job was to tell immigrant after immigrant that, sorry, I can't help you, because here's the limits under the current law. Whether that's people who are here unlawfully now or people who are trying to help their relatives abroad to come lawfully. And I think the biggest single flaw is in that employment category. There's 5,000 employer-sponsored immigrant visas available each year for other than highly skilled immigrants. 5,000 is a really low number for the whole of the United States. I mean, for comparison, 100 years ago to Ellis Island, 5,000 immigrants entered per day, and very few of them had master's degrees. But that's now, at least in that employment category. So others come through family relationships, others come as refugee, but fairly small numbers at this point. 25,000 refugees are coming this year. Roughly based on projections. So it's that in my mind. Again, I'm not condoning illegal immigration. I don't think it's a good thing. I think it should be much more difficult to immigrate illegally, but concurrently it should be easier to immigrate legally. Because when we do one without the other, the laws of supply and demand are very strong. And when people are earning a dollar per day or a dollar an hour, and they hear you can earn $15 per hour if you get over that fence or if you can get a temporary visa and overstay, I think most of us understand why people would make that decision. I'm not condoning it, but I understand it for sure. I lived in Nicaragua where, there's a lot of extreme poverty. So I would like to see a visa system that matched the needs of the U.S. labor market as close as we could approximate.
I'm going to take pastoral prerogative here. Could you mention a couple of those economists? You say most economists. Could you mention a few?
Yeah. Giovanni Peri, P-E-R-I, is a really good one. There's actually a really thorough study by, now I got to remember what this is, the National Academy of Science, Engineering, Math, something like that. We quote this in our book. They did just a few years ago, which is basically a really thorough analysis by a whole bunch of economists looking at immigration issues. And the findings were the net economic impact of immigration is positive, meaning our economy is better off because of immigrants are here than if they weren't here. The net effect on wages is positive for most U.S. citizens, but there's a bit of a debate among what the effect is on the least educated U.S. citizens, who are the most likely to basically be in direct competition with unskilled. And I don't even like the term unskilled because I don't have the skills to pick strawberries 12 hours a day, but those we'd consider as other than highly skilled. Some economists actually think there is still a positive impact, and part of that is that immigrants are consumers as well. So yes, they're taking a job, but if you go to a fast food restaurant and there's an immigrant behind the counter serving you, you might want to turn around and see what percentage of the people ordering hamburgers are also immigrants. And that'll vary depending on the geography of the country. Where I live, it's a lot. It's most of the people who are buying hamburgers are also immigrants. And that creates jobs. So the economy is not one pie that if, we cut it into 12 pieces instead of 10, we all get a smaller piece. The pie can actually grow, and that's something that almost all economists agree with. One particular finding that I think is helpful, the Wall Street Journal did a study of economists a few years back, and they found that 96% said that the net economic impact of illegal immigration in particular was positive. It's also actually worth noting that actually illegal immigration is probably in some ways better for the U.S. economy than legal immigration in some perverse ways, because those people actually pay into taxes. I think a lot of people don't realize that, but they're all paying sales tax, they're all paying property tax, and at least half of them are paying income taxes taken out of their payroll, which was usually a job gotten with a false social security number, but then they don't qualify for many of the benefits that those taxes pay for. So, for example, unauthorized immigrants with a number that doesn't match your name on the card paid in $12 billion more in social security in, I think this was 2015, than they could take out, because you can't use your bogus social security number to benefit. But you can effectively subsidize the social security system for my grandparents and other people, soon my parents, who have been paying in for years past. And I don't think that most Americans, I certainly never understood that. But if you think about it, if you look at your social security card, it looks like it was made with blue construction paper and a typewriter. Like, we could come up with a more secure document if we wanted to make sure that no one was working without authorization in 2018. Like, your passport has, a chip in it. Your credit card is, I think they're tracking you everywhere. Your Social Security card is, a flimsy piece of paper. And the reality is there are certain industries that very much want to be able to say, and some of them exploit their workers, but a lot of them really just want good workers and are treating them well. They want to be able to say, we looked at something that was like a Social Security card. We entered it. We sent it off to the federal government. We took out the taxes we were supposed to. And they, at that point, met their legal obligation. And that's where I'm not saying the immigrants are without fault here, but I think the whole system is something of a farce, because we rely upon these people's labor, and we all like cheap produce and milk and, all the things that we benefit from agriculture. And certain jobs are upstream and downstream, whether that's transportation or selling things to the agricultural industry. And I'm picking on agriculture, but it would be true in the restaurant industry, in the, in so many different industries around the U.S. economy. It's so much more complex than just the immigrants for all.
I know, just mention really quickly, actually, just for me personally, when I first came to the U.S., even though I was not granted Social Security, I was given an individual tax identification number, an ITIN number, for which I can pay taxes for whenever I was ready to work and pay taxes. So actually anyone, regardless of their legal status, can apply for this ITIN number. To pay taxes. And actually, there have been studies where the IRS will communicate with immigrant populations. There was a study, I think, out of University of Texas in Houston, about how Thiers communicates, sometimes implicitly, but in ways that please pay your taxes and we will not communicate with the Department of Homeland Security, so you don't have to worry about that. So it speaks to the duplicity of our immigration system as well.
And not just implicitly, the Social Security Administration has like been quoted in the New York Times saying that, like, you should file and pay your taxes. And most immigrants that I know, and I don't want to say it's a representative sample, but most of them have taken that for, you know, something they can rely on, and I know immigrants who are more afraid of the IRS than they are of the Department of Homeland Security, because they've heard you better file and pay your taxes. And some of that is they've heard that someday immigration reform is going to pass, and they're going to have to see so many years of back taxes paid. Some of it is, well, you can't get an earned income tax credit, so if you're a tax lawyer, you can, you know, it's complicated, but if even one person on the return has an ITIN instead of a valid Social Security number, you can't get that benefit of like an earned income tax credit. But if you overpaid from your payroll taxes, you can get a refund. So that's another reason that people file their taxes, because like many of us, you know, overpay in our payroll taxes and get a little bit back at the end of the year.
Hi, my name is Jim Kaler, and I've spent better than 3 years of my life living outside of the United States. And so I don't consider myself xenophobic in some ways, but I do consider myself Islamic phobic in some ways, because they have declared war on us as a culture. And so I want to know, in terms of yourself, Matthew, I have a question in terms of World Relief gets 70% of its funding from the U.S. government grants. And so I want to know tonight, are you here as a government contractor or are you here as a ministry? And then secondly, I'd like to know, what is it with Islamic law that, in Sharia law, is what I'm trying to say, Canada is having quite a problem with it, Europe has a very much of a problem with it, and I would like a rather candid kind of conversation about the Islamic problem, because all the other immigrants I find no problem with, but we are concerned with those who are hostile towards us, and when they even do come to our nation, they are isolating themselves in terms of enclaves, and they are not wanting to assimilate into our culture. Not saying that I want them to change their food, but when they demand, such as in Toronto, that the schools are serving halal food, and when they turn the gymnasium on Friday afternoon into a mosque so that they can be religiously taught, those kind of things, I think, need to be discussed. And we need to face them as adults and have a frank conversation about these kinds of things. Thank you.
Yeah, so several issues to address there. First, in terms of World Relief, so World Relief does work with the U.S. State Department to resettle refugees. And as I said, we've done that since the 70s. As part of that arrangement, we receive a grant from the federal government for the services that we provide to refugees and that we pass on to refugees, actually, because basically we get about $2,000 per refugee that arrives. The majority of that goes to covering rents for the first 3 months. Now, that 70% figure will be off in the recent years because the number of refugees arriving in the last few years has gone way down, and the share of our budget that is from the Federal Refugee Resettlement Grant is way, way down. And that also includes some of the work we do internationally as well. But you know, we really believe that it's been a really successful public-private partnership. So we do a lot to raise funds from churches and to work with local churches to resettle refugees. The federal government knows that that's our model, that it has been our model since the 70s, and they have seen that as a really successful model. I actually believe that the federal government couldn't resettle refugees nearly as effectively as they do if they didn't work through faith-based organizations. If they were only relying on government employees, it turns out most people don't volunteer to work with the government. And, you know, even outside of faith-based organizations, if they would say, well, we just are going to work with secular NGOs, and a few of the resettlement agencies are not faith-based, you know, I think that we are able to leverage so many hours of volunteer time and in-kind donations and private contributions, which we rely on even more now because so few refugees are arriving. Just for context, the number of refugees was 100,000. It was 99,000 in 2016. It was down to about 30,000 in 2017. And it's, again, we expect 22,000 in this fiscal year. So it's gone down a lot, and I'm not primarily concerned about the effect of that on World Relief, but about the impact on refugees who, because we often know their family members who are waiting for that reunification. So the other question was around Muslims. It is important to note that the vast majority of immigrants to the United States are not Muslim. Again, most are actually Catholic or Protestant Christians, and part of that is fueled by Latin America, which is largely Catholic and increasingly a good share Protestant. But my view of Islam is, of course, I'm a Christian who thinks that Muslims need Jesus. I think it's a unique opportunity that when they come here for us to share Jesus. But I also have a lot of Muslim friends, some of whom have come to faith in Christ, some of whom have not yet. And first of all, I think it's important to note that just like a lot of self-described Christians, a lot of Muslims are fairly nominal. For all the concerns that a lot of Americans have about Sharia law, a good number of my Muslim friends don't know what that is. And they also, a lot of my Christian refugee friends couldn't tell you what the Nicene Creed was. You know, it's like they're not necessarily deeply committed to their faith. There are other refugees who are deeply committed to their faith, and I think that's where religious freedom is a really important principle that's enshrined in our Constitution for good reason. And I think that goes back to that idea of the golden rule, that we want to, that if we just have religious freedom for Christians, then we don't actually have religious freedom. If we only, you know, say, you know, if we at any point allow the government to decide what is an acceptable expression of faith, that can very quickly be turned on us. Because frankly, a lot of political views that evangelical Christians have today are no longer in the mainstream of viewed as acceptable and normal views, whether that's on views on marriage or certain other things. So I think holding to a standard of religious freedom is very important. Now, I can't speak to examples from Canada because they have a different constitution that I'm not really familiar with. But in the U.S., we have a First Amendment that neither establishes a religion and it also allows each of us the practice of our faith. And that's not just the worship service, but the way we apply that to our lives. One thing, and I'm not an expert on Islam, but I have colleagues who are Christians who have studied this really thoroughly. The idea of Sharia law gets a lot of press, and I think it's, you know, it's a very confusing topic. Sharia in Islam is basically religious law. In some countries, Sharia law is the law of the state. But if you poll American Muslims, the vast majority, if you ask them, do you believe in Sharia, some of them will say no, some of them will say yes. The same way if you poll evangelical Christians and said, do you believe in biblical law? A lot would say yes, a lot would say, you know, might not know what you're saying by that. If you ask American Muslims, do you want Sharia to be the law of the state? The vast majority say no. And many of them are coming from countries where that was not good for them. And they don't want that to be the case in the United States. We don't have Sharia law in the United States. You can read on the internet that certain communities are under Sharia law. I've been told that the state of Illinois is under Sharia law. I can promise you, I live there, it's not. I was told the city of New York City is under Sharia law. It's really not. In fact, it's one of the more liberal cities you could find around the United States. I think it's really important that our approach to Muslims should be that we would extend to them the same courtesy that we want for ourselves, to be able to define for ourselves what we believe. There's more than a billion Muslims in the world, and they don't all believe the same thing, the same way that not all Christians believe the same thing. And I get offended when someone goes on television and says that all evangelical Christians are hucksters trying to steal money from poor people to fly their private planes, but I've not actually met a pastor who flies a private plane for the money he, you know, did from some televangelism scheme, and I don't think that's a fair example of most Christians. That being the case, I want to prescribe the same grace to Muslims. And I've had a Muslim roommate for a while. I've known a lot of Muslims who have a whole wide range of views. Again, some of them are much more religious than others. There's so many different sects of Islam and different traditions. But I feel really strongly that if we can't love people well if we're afraid of them. And I'm not saying everyone's afraid of Islam, but if you use the term Islamophobic, we can't love people, we certainly can't reach people whom we're afraid of.
You use a statistic, my name's Rob. You use a statistic, 12% of evangelicals, only 12% of evangelicals base their view on immigration from the Bible. How do you think we could improve that figure and get that number up a little higher to help evangelicals understand this issue from a biblical point of view? Thank you.
I love that question. I'll pay you later. You know, the other thing we found in that survey was that 21% of evangelical Christians said they'd ever heard a message on this topic at church. So you all are starting in the right place by even having a conversation. And that doesn't mean we all have to agree on how we interpret the scriptures, but to at least lay out, well, what does the Bible say on this? And most churches, they don't ever have that conversation. And I understand that, frankly. I've been in churches where there's a scripture reading and it's about the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow, and almost inevitably, the sermon's on orphans. And we should talk about orphans, and we should care for orphans. But part of that, I have, maybe it's my cynical side, but I wonder if not a lot of people send angry emails about orphan sermons, but they do about immigration sermons. And, you know, so first of all, I want to thank the church here for engaging some tough topics, not just immigration, but you've done a number of tough topics in this Faith Forum series. But I think helping more churches do that, we've tried to put resources together. One, which I'm intended to mention, and this is a good reminder, we've got this bookmark, which is at a table in the back on your way out. It's very simply 40 scripture passages that relate in one way or another to the topic of immigration. So it doesn't tell you who to vote for, it doesn't tell you what immigration policy should be, it doesn't even tell you which Bible translation to use, because that could cause a fight. It just is 40 scripture passages. And we've had a lot of people, you know, stick this in their Bible, or if, like me, when I'm traveling, you read your Bible on your phone, it's also on the YouVersion Bible app. You can just search for, well, if you go to the website on the bottom of the bookmark, it'll give you a link. And we've challenged people, would you read one verse per day for 40 days? And we've had lots of people do that. Actually, a couple hundred thousand people have told us they were downloading this bookmark. And I've had a number of people come back to me and say, wow, I had no idea the Bible said anything on this topic. But it was like getting hit over the head with the Bible 40 days in a row. There's so much there. I had a member of Congress tell me, I've never thought about this before, and I've been in church my whole life. And it changed the way he thinks about the issue. Again, it may or may not change the way he votes on policy, because I'm not telling you that you'll get an immigration policy in some sort of hidden code in the Bible. But we do know some things about God's character from the scriptures. And then I think there's good space for debate on what's the best policy solution. I actually don't think there's that much room for debate within the church on how do we treat our neighbors. I think that one's just pretty clear. And I don't think you can really argue you have to be very creative to try to argue that immigrants are not your neighbors.
Okay. Yes. We've heard about the Evangelical Immigration Table. It's been characterized as an organization. What do you guys have to say about the fact that it was actually founded as an outreach tool to reach Christians through the National Immigration Forum, which has received over $4 million in grant requests funded from 2009 to 2015, including specifically in 2014 a $400,000 grant request to do outreach to evangelicals. That funding all coming from billionaire, anti-Christian, atheist George Soros. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I've been a part of the Evangelical Immigration Table since it started in 2011. It's led by World Relief, the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, the National Association of Evangelicals, the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, the Korean Churches for Christian Community Development, the Wesleyan Church, and the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. So I helped coordinate that effort. I do have friends who work at the National Immigration Forum. They have helped us facilitate that effort, and I've been grateful for that. My boss, when I worked there for a short time, was a Nazarene pastor, and they're a nonpartisan organization that also gets funds from Walmart and the Chamber of Commerce and a whole range of sources. But we have actually asked them that we don't want any funds from that particular donor to support the specific work of the Evangelical Immigration Table, and they haven't. But they know a lot about immigration policy, and they've been a really significant help in bringing together Christian voices with business voices, with law enforcement voices, and a broad range of perspectives. I can assure you, and I'm intimately involved in this, they don't get a veto on any position that we take. It's a vote of the organizations that are all Christian organizations. But they do help provide the facilitation.
Is that how it was originally started, arranged?
Yep, it was basically started at a meeting at O'Hare Airport in 2011 that I helped pull together, where we brought in leaders from a bunch of evangelical denominations, and we came up with a statement of principles and said, what are the things that evangelical Christians can agree on, and how do we help begin this conversation in the church? Because, you know, even without having done the polling from Lifeway at that point, we had a pretty good sense that most churches weren't talking about these issues. We kind of launched that in June 2012 with the statement of principles. You can find that at the Evangelical Congregation Table website, which is just evangelicalcongregationtable.com. Our goal is to encourage distinctly biblical conversations in the church, and then encourage that to influence public policy questions as well.
So you don't see this as an effort of the worldly left to use and exploit the church as the church has been exploited in its history by various other political factions?
I can tell you, as the coordinator for the Evangelical Immigration Table, my effort is to help Christians think biblically about immigration issues, and that's something I'm really passionate about. And I don't see it as a partisan issue at all.
Brief note on the Bible. You noted, for example, that Jesus was a refugee. He actually never left. I guess it depends on how he traveled, but he would have been under Roman rule in Roman territory his entire time. So is that a accurate and honest argument to make that he was a refugee?
No, I think it's pretty clear from the text that that Joseph's understanding was from going to Egypt was that he was outside of the danger from Pharaoh.
So does that answer my question?
I don't know. You can decide that.
So can the people here. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Brenda. Thank you again. This has been really enlightening and really informing. Let me preface this question. I know we're not here to talk about policy, but I'm sure in your organization you dreamcast about what you would like policy to look like. What should we be praying for to keep the scripture at the center to make sure we get the right policies to honor the Lord? Thank you.
I'll start maybe. So Matt referred to this when he was addressing the other question about the statement of principles that the Evangelical Immigration Table launched. And a lot of it is coming to understand we're not legislators or we're not writing policy, but how can we inform policy that reflects God's heart for immigrants? So in this set of six very broad principles, we say, well, any type of reform to immigration should honor the God-given dignity of every individual. It should keep family united, so maintaining the unity of the family. It should respect taxpayers. When we talk about restoring the rule of law, technically, if we're in full and complete enforcement of the law, then the 11 million or so undocumented immigrants should be deported, right? Mass deportation. And you'll find that there is no political will to do that across the political spectrum, simply because the cost of removing, rounding everyone up and sending them back. There are estimates that place anywhere from, even conservative estimates that say $400 to $600 billion, and that's not taking into account the economic loss of losing those consumers and workers. And we talk about that any reform to law should also secure borders. So we talk about, again, we are for borders to be secured for good, effective interior enforcement, so that when people come in our case, and they overstay their visa or if they cross the border illegal, there's not a great way to track that. And that's because we have a visa system, right? Because immigration is such a dynamic system. In that economic push and pull, we need these people to work. They're quickly absorbed into the workforce, and yet we're not willing to allow them to come out of the shadows. So we're saying, how do we be able to address this visa issue so that we have a system that meets the labor demands of the United States, but then also then allow us to really hone in, focus on those who do pose a threat to national security or public safety? Because right now it's a blanket catch-all. You have 11 million people. There's not the manpower or financial resources to tackle every single one of them. But how do we do so, have an effective system where we can really focus on those who do harm, who pose of harm? We also talk about probably the most contentious issue is allowing those who are currently undocumented to earn their way, not amnesty, but to earn their way, whether it's waiting a longer line, paying a fee, but jumping through additional hoops to be able to gain status. Because the current system, putting that 11 million or allowing that 11 million or so undocumented immigrants remain in the shadows is unsustainable and only gets worse.
The only thing I would add to that is I think it's partially because I think the rule of law is important that I don't think the status quo is a good plan. Because in general in the United States, we have a high level of respect for the rule of law. Like in this country, you can pull up to a red light at 4 in the morning and most nice people in Wisconsin will sit there for 3 minutes waiting for it to turn green. Like, it wouldn't even occur to most of us that we should just go through that because no one's coming. There's parts of the world where the appropriate response to a red light is to honk as you're going through. We generally have a high respect for the rule of law. And I think our immigration laws are a big glaring exception to that. Because again, the laws were written decades ago in many cases, and they're so out of touch with the needs of the labor market that it's never actually been politically feasible to fully enforce the law. Because that would mean mass deportation. It would mean splitting up all sorts of families where your kids are born as U.S. citizens. You can like that or not, but it's the Constitution. It's the economic consequences of that are dramatic. So under either Republican or Democratic administrations, there's never been the will to say, we're actually going to fully enforce the law. But the effect is we have this kind of winking and nodding system. And I will say the borders are a lot more secure now than they were 10 or 20 years ago. There has been real resources put into border security to the point where now most new undocumented immigrants are not coming across the border. They're overstaying visas, the significant majority in the last 7 or 8 years. But still, we have this situation where if you manage to get here unlawfully, you will almost certainly get a job. You will almost certainly fit into the economy quite quickly because there is a labor market that wants your work. And fit in as a consumer. We want you to consume. And we even want you to pay your taxes. But what happens when we don't fully enforce the law is the law starts, the value of the rule of law starts to erode. The same way that, you know, go back to driving in Chicagoland, when nobody ever gets a speeding ticket for going 56 miles per hour, most of us, and I know I'm from Wisconsin, so I know you're safer drivers here than in Chicago, but most of us think that actually we can go a little bit over 55 miles an hour. And we all have our own sort of interpretation of how much over is acceptable, and we judge the people going way over. But there's not a real standard, except for that I've never heard of anyone getting a speeding ticket for going 5 miles over the speed limit on an interstate. My general view would be, and you see this when you drive from Wisconsin to Illinois on 94, the speed limit drops from like 70 to 55, and everybody speeds up by 5 miles an hour, because they know the police are not going to give you a ticket there. My view is I like the Wisconsin system better, where you might get a speeding ticket a few miles over the speed limit, and the speed limit should be higher. I think our immigration visa system should be set higher to meet the needs of the U.S. labor market, and then that allows you to enforce it more strictly. And then you got to deal with people who came 20 years ago, where at this point I don't think it would be humane to have ignored them for this long and then suddenly say you're out, especially when they have families here, the economic consequences are dramatic. I think what's the way that says it's not okay to break the law? And I do think there's a distinction for someone who was brought as a 4-year-old compared to someone who came as a 24-year-old. It's not okay to break the law. There's a consequence for that. If you can pass a criminal background check, you haven't committed serious crimes, you're going to pay this fine, and then you're going to get a probationary legal status, and you can show over the course of a number of years that you're working, you're paying taxes, you're not in any sort of criminal problem, and then if you can meet all those requirements, you could earn permanent legal status and eventually citizenship. That's the sort of proposal that I think it both honors the law and is realistic and compassionate to the complex situations that people are in.
Hello, my name is Levi. Liz, you mentioned the questionable legality of Obama's executive order for DACA. What do you think of it being repealed and Trump advocating for it to be taken care of by Congress? I don't know the legality behind the executive order, but you had a personal experience with its enactment, so what do you think?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. I'm in full agreement that Congress should be the body, as mentioned earlier, on enacting laws. Congress should be passing immigration legislation. So the deferred action was implemented at a time where, and the reason I mentioned that people like me, people who came here as children, referred to as dreamers, were actually namesake for a bill called the DREAM Act, Development Relief Education for Alien Minors, that was first introduced in 2001. And that has been repeatedly introduced in several sessions, congressional sessions. And at various cases, it came very close to passing. At one time, it was like short 5 votes from passing filibustering. But anyway, it failed to do that. And that was at a time where the DREAM Act originally was co-sponsored by Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, Democrat, and then Senator Orrin Hatch, a Republican from Utah. And so that was at a time where, okay, we're not at a place where we can pass comprehensive immigration reform, but how can we provide protection for this particular group of immigrants that we see as uniquely vulnerable? They came as children, so obviously, as a minor, you just go where your parents went, right? You don't have a choice to stay behind. So they didn't make that decision. How can we provide protection for this group? So that's kind of the intention behind the DREAM Act. And as mentioned, it failed to pass. And so in 2012, under the Obama administration, they said, short of Congress, because Congress is not able to pass legislation, let's put a temporary protection around this particular group. At the time, I think 1.6 million individuals would have qualified. But only 800,000 or so applied, many out of fear, various instances. So the DACA was rescinded, repealed September 5th, but we're also very grateful for the fact that President Trump has explicitly expressed his desire to see Congress act on Dreamers, going as far as saying providing citizenship in a State of the Union citizenship for the 1.6 million immigrants. So we find that very encouraging, and we hope, we've been praying and really advocating that Congress does take heed of that and work towards a solution. And so far, there has been efforts, but none have passed. But we're also mindful of the fact there has been additional kind of elements being introduced in the discussion around immigration, and that is a reduction on legal immigration, which is something that we're concerned about. At a time where, you know, I was reading stats about just taking it close to home, Wisconsin, I think from 2000 to 2010, only saw 6% of population growth. And in several counties out of the 72 or so here, there was actually negative population decline, right? So when we talk about at a time where the economy is growing, we actually need a growing population, a growing workforce, this is not a time to cut back legal immigration. And to do so at the expense of family reunification, keeping families together, bringing families together. So President Trump, we really believe that President Trump has the heart to both see the border secured and then also providing this pathway for Dreamers. Now it's just additional elements that were introduced, some say maybe influenced by individuals within the administration, but not Trump, President Trump himself, that have complicated the process. So that's where we stand, is really helping to advocate what President Trump has initially expressed, border security, pathway for Dreamers, but not, again, not use that as sort of this leverage or as a kind of political football for immigration reduction.
Hi, my name is Kat. I share a unique hatred of government bureaucracy. I used to work for Congress. so I can share your frustration with all laws basically being completely out of date. But I have a question about your bookmark. When I heard you guys were coming, I looked up the bookmark and I started reading and reading through it and praying through it. And when I talk with liberal friends about the issue of homosexuality, something in particular comes up. I want to read you from Exodus 22. Where is it? 22 or 21, excuse me. You shall not wrong the sojourner or oppress him, for you are sojourners in the land of Egypt. That's part of your bookmark. Above this, if a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make him her wife. Whatever. Continuing, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. Whoever shall lie with an animal shall be put to death. Whoever sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be devoted to destruction. So that's the context of that verse. I'm told my viewpoint on homosexual marriage is wrong because of these verses. Can you speak to why the bookmark would make reference to verses that are in context with these and why that makes it valid?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question, because what I'm not suggesting with the bookmark is we should take the Deuteronomical laws or the laws in the Pentateuch and turn them into U.S. law. And I don't think you're arguing that either by maintaining a biblical view of marriage, which I think I probably agree with you on. I think what we can know from some of these passages in Scripture, I also don't think the response is we should cut that part of the Bible out, which is I don't think an evangelical view of the authority of Scripture allows us to do that. I think you do read them in context. And a verse like Exodus 22:21, where God tells the Israelites, because you were sojourners in Egypt, you should, treat those who are sojourners among you fairly, tells us something about God's character. And I think that, and especially because it's emphasized and reiterated in passages in the New Testament as well. So hermeneutics is super complicated, and it's not as simple as picking out one verse. And I get that that's a limitation of 40 Bible verses, because there isn't context. Our hope is that you dive deeper into looking at the context. A great resource to do that, Daniel Carroll, who's an Old Testament scholar, he was at Denver Seminary, he just moved to Wheaton College, his grad school, has a book called Christians at the Border, and he's a theologically conservative Old Testament scholar who I think does a really good job of exploring the passages in the Old Testament about how to treat immigrants, especially in the context of how other ancient Near Eastern religions were telling people how to treat foreigners, and it's a place in which God's commandments are actually very countercultural, but also to explore that in the context of the whole of the scripture and the whole of the biblical narrative. Again, we could also make a fairly strong case on this just off of Luke 10 and loving your neighbor as yourself, but I don't think we can just cut out the Old Testament and say this doesn't matter, and I don't think that's what you're saying either. But I completely agree with you. You have to read the passages in context.
Yeah, Dwayne Madison, this is for Liz. I heard, if I understood right, your mother was here before you, and so you got quite a few years that you've been here, but I haven't heard you mention, you've talked about your green cards and visas, but I haven't heard you mention trying for citizenship. I was wondering why.
Yeah, so in order to attain citizenship for an immigrant, you have to go through this long process, complicated process, but first you have to become a legal permanent resident or a green card holder. So my mom, that's the process that she started, which didn't come through, yeah.
And just to clarify, I think this is a really common question. And again, it goes back to, I used to think that people who wanted to become citizens should go sign up for that. There's not a process in current U.S. immigration law for most people who are present unlawfully. A few of them there are. I mean, when I was a legal counselor, you'd find the needles in the haystack where you could help someone. But again, it goes back to, do you have the right family sponsor? Do you have the right employer sponsor? Do you have a well-founded fear of persecution? Or did you enter the diversity visa lottery from an underrepresented country? And then they have to consider, have you been here unlawfully in the past? So for example, in Liz's case, she has now accumulated a good number of years of unlawful presence before the DACA program began. If she left the United States without this being resolved, she could trigger a 10-year bar to permanent legal status, but she would still need one of those options to petition her. And I haven't been your legal counselor, Liz, but you don't have the requisite family member. You might be at the point of, I mean, she's finishing her MBA at the University of Chicago soon, so if you wanted to go wait 10 years abroad, I think it's fairly possible with an MBA from the University of Chicago, you might get an employer-sponsored immigrant visa. But that wouldn't have been an option when you were 12 and you didn't have a master's degree. And you're not fleeing persecution and you're not, you're not an underrepresented country. China is one of the top countries for immigrants to the United States. So any individual case you can look at, you know, do they fit into any of these categories? And for the vast majority, the reason they're not signing up for citizenship is they don't qualify to do so.
You know what? I just realized something. We were supposed to be done at 8:30. For the longest time I was thinking, I was looking back, I was like, we got plenty of time, we'll be done at 9. So I'm sorry. We'll just count it as one of my sermons, okay? I always think I'll be done earlier than I think than I actually am. But so, Jake, are you okay to just ask the question personally afterward?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, thank you very much. So I just realized that. So, Zach, are you okay just to come up here briefly? Thank you. Let's clap for...
I do believe Matt and Liz will probably be around just for a little bit afterward. I know you guys got to head out, but maybe a few, at least Jay's question to go that route. And then Zach just wants to talk a little bit about his experience and then give a shout out to some of the ministries that are here, right?
Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Zach, Simon, everybody.
Yeah, so my wife Angie and I were commissioned by FCC in 2016 to move to Minneapolis. And so we've lived there in the Phillips neighborhood, which is considered one of the most diverse neighborhoods in America, with over 100 languages spoken. And so I just wanted to basically say that my wife and I are here tonight, along with Terry Nanda, who I'm sure many of you know, who is connected with the All Nations House, connecting with international students at UW River Falls. Great ministry, which I also was involved, my wife and I were involved with several years. So I'd really commend that to you, as well as Carl and Julie Gady with Tutapona. And so we just wanted to have some people here who can kind of give you some next steps if you're curious, especially in showing that hospitality, that love for strangers. I know my wife and I, you know, we had some of our Muslim neighbors over for dinner on Friday night, and so I'd love to talk to you about what that's like, you know, and just how to love the people that God's bringing and the great opportunity that we have to love and make disciples of all nations right here in our country. So yeah, come and talk to us afterward.
Thank you, Zach. Let me pray. Let's do it later. Thanks, Medora. Yeah, because I want to make sure, you know, we're nice Wisconsinites here. People are waiting for us to dismiss so they can leave. Like, I don't want to get up. Everybody's going to think I'm this. And so we'll just, yeah, so that's why. All right. Merciful Father, thank you for your grace and your goodness. Thank you for Matt and Liz and for their help. Thank you for their humility. Thank you for their willingness to take pointed questions. God, I ask that you would give us wisdom. May we wrestle with your scriptures. May we seek to live out your scriptures. Would you grant that we would love our neighbors as you've taught us to do, to love our neighbors as we love ourselves? I ask for your grace and your mercy in these things. And God, I ask that you would work. You hold kings' hearts in your hand. You hold Congress people's hearts in your hands. You hold senators in your hands. You hold presidents in your hands. And those decisions are ultimately, you work them through. And so, God, I ask that our elected officials would be wise and that they would enact laws that are good for the country and good for human flourishing and good for productivity and good for economic growth and good for individuals and families. God, that task is huge. And so, God, we intercede on their behalf for the sake of our neighbors and for our own sake, God.